The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting the latest vision news. Today's vision news is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. First up from the acb.org, lawsuit brought against Section 504. Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 is a pivotal law to uphold the rights of people with disabilities. The law says that all programs receiving federal funding, which is a substantial portion of the programs, must provide accommodations for persons with disabilities. We believe that the law is extremely vulnerable at this time. In September of 2024, a lawsuit was brought by 17 states against the U.S. government to overturn the law. This would enable services receiving federal dollars to stop providing the necessary accommodations our community so greatly needs. For instance, medical providers could simply choose to make their online services inaccessible for blind and low vision patients, and our population would have no legal recourse to fight back. The first round of regulations for Section 504 was implemented by the government in 1977, 4 years after the adoption of the law. A new and greatly needed update to the regulations was not adopted until 2024. ACB played a role in drafting comments for the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking that was used to develop the eventual updated regulations. ACB is deeply concerned to see the potential abandonment of all the work we have done to help advance our rights. The lawsuit, Texas versus Becerra, B-E-C-E-R-R-A, was brought by the following states: Alaska, Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, Utah, and West Virginia. Advocates urge residents of the 17 states to contact their state attorneys general and explain why the elimination of Section 504 would be so detrimental for people with disabilities. If your state is not one of the listed 17 states, you can also contact your state's attorney general and encourage them to draft an amicus brief for the pending lawsuit. A coalition of disability advocates held a webinar on February 12th to outline the issue and provide advocacy suggestions. As soon as the recording is available, ACB will share it via email and online. ACB is following the issue closely and will participate in advocacy work to protect Section 504. Posted February 13, 2025. There is more on this lawsuit from DisabilityScoop.com. Lawsuit filed by 17 states threatens disability protections, advocates say. Over a dozen states are seeking to invalidate one of the nation's key disability rights laws. Advocates are warning, jeopardizing access to health care, education, and more. A lawsuit brought by Texas and 16 other states is calling for an end to Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. The 1973 law bars discrimination on the basis of disability at any entity that receives federal funds. The suit, known as Texas versus Becerra, was filed in response to an update to Section 504 regulations that was finalized by the Biden administration last year. With the litigation, the states are looking to ensure that gender dysphoria does not qualify as a disability under the rule. However, in challenging the regulations, the state's lawsuit asks the court to declare Section 504, 29 U.S.C. Code 794, unconstitutional in its entirety. If this happens, it would be a disaster for disabled people, and everything from education to employment would be negatively impacted, said Maria Town, president and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities. Section 504 has a broad reach, extending to health care, public education, housing, transportation, and much more, advocates say. While many students with disabilities are covered by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, federal figures show that 3% of students are served under Section 504 alone. The latest 504 regulations clarified that medical providers cannot make treatment decisions based on disability biases, expanded the availability of accessible medical diagnostic equipment, and set expectations for accessibility on providers' websites and mobile applications, among other changes. If the court were to determine that Section 504 is unconstitutional, disability advocates are concerned that the basis of such a decision would also undermine other laws, including the Americans with Disabilities Act. If the judge were to adopt it and it actually declare the statute unconstitutional, it could portend that other anti-discrimination statutes based on race and sex and ethnicity are also unconstitutional for the same reason. Stephen Schwartz, senior counsel at the Center for Public Representation, said during a recent webinar, and because there's provisions in the regulations that tie together that link 504 and the ADA, and prohibitions on race and sex discrimination, it links them all in how they're enforced. Striking down the rule might imperil the ADA as well. Disability advocates across the nation are now calling for states to back out of the litigation. And facing significant pressure, the attorneys general are attempting to distance themselves from the suit's request to overturn Section 504. Plaintiffs clarify that they have never moved and do not plan to move the court to declare or enjoin Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, 29 U.S.C. Code 794, as unconstitutional on its face, reads a joint status report. The states filed with the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas Wednesday. The attorneys general indicated in the filing that they are continuing to evaluate their position in light of a recent executive order President Donald Trump issued on gender ideology. But a statement from South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson's office said that the filing is a big step towards this lawsuit winding down and going away entirely. However, the latest filing is not easing concerns from advocates. Despite representations from several attorneys general that the lawsuit would be dropped, they'd withdraw from the lawsuit, or they'd withdraw the constitutional challenge to Section 504, none of that occurred. They did not file an amended complaint, so the claims and scope of the case remain unchanged, said Allison Barkoff, a professor at George Washington University, who led the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration on community living under the Biden administration. Rather, Barkoff said that the filing actually doubles down on the state's constitutional claim. As an example, they claim the rule's requirement to provide services in the most integrated setting, consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Olmstead v. L.C., is unconstitutional, Barkoff said. If a court were to agree with them, not only would it undermine 25 years of progress through Olmstead enforcement, but it would also mean that Section 504 would not apply to the entities that receive federal health care, education, housing, or transportation funding. In addition to Texas and South Carolina, the other states involved in the lawsuit, which I already listed in the previous reading, the case is currently paused with another update expected this month. Updated February 2025 at 11:20 p.m. Read more stories at Disability Scoop's free email newsletter to get the latest developmental disability news sent straight to your inbox. From the National Council on Aging at ncoa.org, who benefits from vision rehabilitation? Posted February 14. Ageism in healthcare delivery can disproportionately affect older people living with blindness and low vision. Although vision rehabilitation services are widely recognized as critical for adults under age 55 who experience significant vision loss, that's not always the case for older people, perpetuating unequal healthcare access, referrals, and outcomes. For adults under 55, vision loss is more likely to be met with referrals for vision rehabilitation services that prioritize independence, employment opportunities, and quality of life. Yet adults 55 plus facing similar vision challenges are less likely to be connected with transformative vision rehabilitation services. Tragically, there is a long-held belief that vision loss is an inevitable part of aging, and that adults 55 plus are less capable of benefiting from rehabilitation. This erroneous belief leads to a systemic failure to prioritize referrals for vision rehabilitation services for adults 55 plus and especially those 65 plus. The issue is further compounded by the high incidence of comorbidities among adults over 55, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease, arthritis, and cognitive decline, all of which can intensify the challenges associated with vision loss. These comorbidities, coupled with vision loss, contribute to double the rates of anxiety and depression among adults 65 plus living with blindness and vision loss compared with their sighted peers. Footnote 1. You can provide life-changing referrals. As a professional working with these adults, you can help break the cycle by providing vital referrals for vision rehabilitation services. Your referrals will help reduce the number of adults who lack access to life-enhancing services and improve physical and mental health outcomes. Without appropriate referrals and access to vision rehabilitation services, older people with blindness or low vision face significantly diminished quality of life and increased safety risks. A lack of services also undermines quality health care delivery, since those who are aging don't receive the same opportunities for independence and well-being afforded to their younger counterparts. Addressing this issue requires systemic change and an unwavering focus on the importance of referrals for adults of all ages with vision loss. Healthcare systems must challenge ageist assumptions by recognizing that vision rehabilitation is essential for adults regardless of age and can help adults 65 plus remain safely and confidently in their homes. Important system changes include, number one, enhanced education and training. Healthcare professionals would greatly benefit from training to understand the value of vision rehabilitation and counteract misperceptions leading to inadequate referrals. Number two, equitable funding models. Policies and funding mechanisms must ensure that vision rehabilitation services are accessible to all age groups, including adults 55 plus living with blindness and low vision. Number three, enhanced referral processes. Systems should be designed to ensure automatic and consistent referrals to vision rehabilitation services for adults 55 plus diagnosed with vision loss, mainly through integration into electronic health record systems. Number four, community outreach. Programs designed to connect older adults with vision loss to rehabilitation services must be expanded to ensure equitable distribution of resources. Number five, research and advocacy. Evidence-based research highlighting the success of vision rehabilitation for adults 55 plus must be amplified, and advocacy efforts should focus on dismantling ageism in healthcare policy and practice. Ageism in healthcare is pervasive, but for those living with vision loss, it dramatically undermines safety, independence, and quality of life. Let your voice be heard. The Department of Health and Human Services Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, has issued a request for information about ageism in healthcare delivery. You can learn more about this request and the opportunity to submit comments by March 15, 2025. AHRQ's focus on this issue is an important step forward, but the voices and experiences of older adults must remain central to these efforts. We must act now to ensure that everyone, regardless of age, is referred to and receives the care and support they deserve. Connecting your clients with local vision rehabilitation services. Take the first step in supporting your clients with blindness and low vision by providing a referral or connecting them with a local vision rehabilitation agency. Access a list of vision rehabilitation agencies at the hotlink and visit Time to Be Bold at the hotlink to locate state and local vision rehabilitation services and other resources in your area. You and your clients can call the APH hotline to receive support and practical coping strategies for everyday tasks. Join remote discussion groups and access free online resources at the APH Connect Center and Vision Aware. National organizations also provide a vast array of information and resources, including American Foundation for the Blind, AFB, National Federation of the Blind, NFB, and National Industries for the Blind, NIB, which provides career and employment information and resources. You can also access a toolkit that professionals can use to enhance support for adults living with blindness and low vision. Learn more about vision rehabilitation through our other articles in this series. There's a list of hot links with bullet points. How vision rehabilitation changes lives, identifying undiagnosed vision loss in older adults, common age-related eye diseases, what to know and what you can do, how to connect older adults to life-changing vision rehabilitation services, how referring older adults to vision rehabilitation can strengthen their medical care, helping people with blindness and vision loss continue to participate in everyday activities. The footnote was from Alliance, Aging and Vision Loss Coalition, and the Ohio State University College of Optometry. Big Data Project Insights for Adults 65 Plus with Vision Loss. Found on the internet at https://visionsurveyalliance.org/big-data-insights-adults-65-and-older/. From NFB.org, the Braille Monitor for February 2025, an article by Kate Mendez, CAYTEMENDEZ, called Why Every Blind Postsecondary Student Should Apply for an NFB Scholarship. From the editor, Kate Mendez chairs the National Federation of the Blind Scholarship Committee. She is a full-time elementary school teacher in the New York City Public Schools and serves as president of the National Organization of Blind Educators, as well as second vice president of the NFB of New York. Here is what she has to say about the benefits not only of receiving an NFB scholarship, but of the application process itself. There is a long intro that I'm going to skip. Each year, the NFB scholarship program receives many times the number of applications than we have scholarships to award. As a result, many winners have applied more than once before being selected. Through the years, as these students, undaunted, continue to submit their evolving applications, the members of the scholarship committee have the privilege to observe them grow and develop as scholars, as leaders, and as individuals. Some of this growth comes from the dedication and perseverance required to complete the scholarship process and the accompanying interview with an NFB affiliate president. Our youngest applicants gain experience through this process that can be applied to their college and career advancement as they take on the responsibility of gathering and submitting all the required application components. Our more experienced applicants gain the opportunity to reflect on their own sense of themselves as blind people and their impact on the world as they complete the essay and the president's interview. One of the most important goals of our national scholarship program is to find, recruit, and encourage new members. As our state scholarship chairs reach out to students in their states and our affiliate presidents conduct their individual interviews, hundreds of potential new leaders and members of our federation have the chance to get to know us for the first time each year. Even before the scholarship committee meets, these applicants have an opportunity to receive the gift of the federation, a gift that will last far longer than scholarship dollars. For those applicants who are already familiar with and involved in the federation, the scholarship application process provides an excellent opportunity to deepen existing relationships with state presidents, as well as to take stock of their personal leadership experiences and the ways they give back to their organization. For the 30 finalists that the scholarship committee selects annually, the announcement of the prizes on banquet night is only one facet of the award. During the NFB's national convention, which all finalists are required to attend in full, scholarship finalists can network with other blind students, exchange information and ideas, and meet with and talk with hundreds of blind people who are successfully employed in many occupations and professions. Our past winners often comment that the money was quickly spent, but the contacts they made and the information they gathered at the convention have continued to make their lives richer than they ever imagined. There is no monetary value that can be assigned to the friendships that develop among the members of a scholarship class, as they support one another during an action-packed week of getting to know the Federation, and sharing their own accomplishments and goals with us. Likewise, there is not a financial equivalent to the unprecedented access our finalists gain every year to the outstanding leaders who serve as members of the scholarship committee. Through discussions with these successful blind mentors, scholarship winners have an unequaled opportunity to get to know our organization's leaders by asking questions and discussing their own ideas and opinions. They also have the chance to make all our Federation experiences richer as they share their own diverse experiences and perspectives with us during the Board of Directors meeting and at student division events. When the gavel drops each year and the convention draws to a close, the rewards of the scholarship program do not come to an end. Our winners continue to deepen their connections and maintain their collaboration with one another as they pursue their various academic degrees and professional goals. They continue to build relationships with the Federation through involvement with their state affiliates, strengthening and evolving the foundations laid during those initial applicant interviews, and enriched during the week of the convention. Our winners develop and strengthen professional networks with other blind people in their chosen fields and with members who share in their intersectional identities through the work of our divisions and groups. They serve on division boards or committees, take on the work of the Federation in their affiliates, and carry what they have learned about the capacity of the blind into their schools, communities, and families. The scholarship checks are mailed and cashed in August, but the rewards of being an NFB scholarship recipient last for a lifetime. Skipping ahead, the deadline for the 2025 application is March 31. If you are a legally blind student, will be enrolled full-time in a U.S. degree program in the fall of 2025 and are able to attend the annual convention of the National Federation of the Blind from July 8 to 13 in New Orleans, Louisiana, I hope that you will grasp the same opportunity that I did 20 years ago and apply for one of the National Federation of the Blind scholarships. This year, the committee is excited to announce a small but impactful change to the NFB scholarship eligibility requirements. Traditionally, each year, one of our scholarships has been made available to an otherwise qualified applicant who is attending school part-time and simultaneously working full-time. Beginning this year, the National Federation of the Blind may award up to 5 scholarships annually to applicants enrolled part-time who meet all other eligibility requirements. We recognize that employment, family caregiving, or ongoing medical care concurrent with post-secondary enrollment can contribute to the need for students to carry a part-time course load. Our application has been revised to allow students who will be enrolled part-time in the fall to share additional information with the committee. The application window closes at midnight Eastern Time on March 31, 2025. Go to www.nfb.org/scholarships. To apply, do the following. Read the rules and the submission checklist. Complete the official 2025 scholarship application form. Supply all required documents. And request and complete an interview with an NFB affiliate president. Remember, the only way to win is to apply. The benefits of engaging in the process will be yours for a lifetime. From the American Printing House for the Blind at aphconnectcenter.org, Recreation and Leisure, If Blind or Low Vision. This content is also available in Spanish. From crafts, woodworking, traveling, and reading to sports and exercise, this section is full of information on the variety of activities people who are blind or low vision can engage in using a few adaptations. Cards and games. We'll introduce you to a wide range of card and board games adapted for people who are blind or low vision. These will enable you to continue with your love of leisure time activities. You can read more at hot links on each of these points. Arts and culture. This content, also available in Spanish, learn how to continue enjoying the theater, art, music, singing in a choir or chorus, and activities such as international travel when you are blind or low vision. There's read more hot link. Entertainment. Find out how to continue enjoying your favorite television shows and learn about podcasts and how to access them at the hot link. Reading and writing. Tablet computers like the iPad, Kindle Fire, and Samsung Galaxy have dramatically changed how we read. For individuals experiencing vision changes, these devices have also increased the overall ease of access to print. Read more at the hot link. arts and crafts if you have blind or low vision. This content also available in Spanish. Many arts and crafts and woodworking activities can be adapted for people who are blind or have low vision. Learn more about how to enjoy these recreational pursuits at the Hot Link. Gardening and yard work. Learn about tips for gardening, including raised bed gardening, from experienced gardeners who are blind or low vision. Read more at the Hot Link. Sports. This content, also available in Spanish, people who are blind or low vision compete and participate in every possible sport. Sometimes the rules are modified, sometimes adaptive techniques are used, and other times adaptive equipment may be required. Learn more about your options at the Hot Link. Exercise if you are blind or low vision. Find tips for developing and maintaining good balance and strength, and advice on exercising safely if you are experiencing pain. Read more at the Hot Link. Finally, from AFB.org, the Reflecting on Braille Literacy Month, which was January, a look at the history of Braille in the United States, just the paragraph on the War of the Dots. Competing codes in the 19th century. Although Louis Braille developed his tactile system in 1829, it wasn't officially introduced to the United States until 1860, when a member of the Missouri School for the Blind's Board of Directors brought it to the school. At that time, people who were blind in the U.S., much like in Europe, were taught to read using raised line printed letters. These letters were difficult to discern, hard to produce, and couldn't be written by blind individuals themselves due to the complexity of their production. Braille revolutionized literacy by not only being easier to read, but also allowing blind individuals to write independently. Despite these advantages, Braille's adoption in the United States was slow. William Bell Waite, W.A.I.T., superintendent of the New York Institution for the Blind, struggled to convince others to adopt Braille. Frustrated, he created his own tactile system, New York Point, which was published in 1868. New York Point was eventually adopted by several schools for the blind, and books in this format were produced by the American Printing House for the Blind. However, with hindsight, New York Point was less efficient than Braille. Its complexity, particularly handling capitalization and punctuation, often led to their omission in printed materials. Around the same time, Joel W. Smith of the Perkins School for the Blind developed American Braille. This system retained Louis Braille's two-column, three-cell structure, but reassigned letters to prioritize the most frequently used ones, reducing the number of dots per letter. Smith also introduced contractions to save space. Interestingly, whenever New York Point and Braille-based systems were evaluated side by side, Braille was consistently deemed superior by those without prior biases. Despite this, New York Point gained widespread adoption, monopolizing book production and dominating schools for the blind during the late 19th century. The reasons behind this likely included the influence and authority of figures like William Bell Waite, who was cited, compared to advocates like Joel Smith, a blind piano tuning teacher. Well, I've run out of time for this week's episode of Vision News. I'm Doris Hyde reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long until next week.